If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Welcome back to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. So today we have a truly remarkable guest joining us. Welcome, Tom Turchich. Tom is not just any traveler. He's a world adventurer who had accomplished an incredible feat. He walked around the world. Tom is the first American to achieve this extraordinary goal and only the 10th person ever to complete a journey of this magnitude. Over the course of 7 years, he traveled across 6 continents, walking tens of thousands of miles through deserts, mountains, jungles, and bustling cities, often accompanied by his loyal companion, Savannah, a dog he adopted along the way. His journey is one of endurance, discovery, and inspiration, a quest driven by a desire to explore life's possibilities and connect with people from all walks of life. Throughout his stories, you'll find lessons on perseverance, humanity, and the power of stepping out of your comfort zone. He even met the woman who now, as of this week, is his fiance. And we are so excited to hear all of his stories. We're excited to delve into his experiences, hear about the challenges and triumphs, and learn what it takes to embark on such an extraordinary journey. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming the world walker himself, Tom Turchich. It is such an honor to have you here with me on Misunderstood. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So are you in New Jersey now? Where are you?
I'm in Kentucky, of all places. My girlfriend is doing her emergency medicine residency in University of Cincinnati. So we're just over the Ohio River in a little house in Kentucky.
Oh my God, I love that. Okay, I have a million questions about how you have dated during this whole process, but... Well, actually, let's start with that since you brought it up. How did you meet this woman?
So we met on the tail end of my 7-year walk. We met in Washington State. I had been kind of dating, seeing this Turkish girl, and she was going to school in the state. She flew back to states. I kind of fell apart. And then I started walking from Seattle on the 7-month walk across the U.S., the last leg. And in a little mountain town after the Northern Cascades National Park, I kind of ran into her and we hit it off, and she was doing this little internal medicine rotation there, and it was Labor Day weekend, so we spent like 5 days together. And then she kind of followed me around as I was walking, you know, 24 miles out a day. She came and met me for dinner, and then she came out to this other town on another weekend, And then she had a rotation in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and she drove all the way up to Idaho to see me. And then she drove out to Wyoming to see me. And then, so yeah, we met and we hit it off. And then she kind of followed me around the US as I walked across it.
Oh my God, I love that. Okay. Yeah. She sounds amazing. So good luck with all that.
She is much more amazing than I am.
Oh God, that's so nice. All right. Well, let's start at the beginning. I found you on Instagram, like a lot of people did, because they started following your journey in general. I fell into, watching you, I guess, at the end, because I saw, what was going on with you and Savannah, your dog. And that was heartbreaking. It was terrible to watch. And I found that I kept checking in to see how the dog was, because I think for a while you were posting about her being sick and you were hoping she would get better. And it was terribly heartbreaking when she didn't make it. So I'm so sorry for your loss. Dogs are, very special to me. I think I like them more than people. And to lose an animal, I know, is one of the most, if not the most painful thing ever, and very hard to get over. So I have so much empathy for what you went through, knowing that you spent her entire life, you guys were together and you guys were best friends.
Yeah. I mean, it was the worst week of my life when she was sick. I just had this like axe in my head, basically, this constant headache, trying to problem solve this problem that wasn't really fixable. And so, yeah. And then afterwards it was obviously incredibly painful, but like you said, we spent basically every minute of every day together for her whole life after I adopted her. And we had this amazing life together. She lived an amazing life. First dog to walk around the world. She saw the world. She smelled the world. She ran across the world. So she had a great adventure. She was 9 years old when she passed, which is obviously younger than I would have liked. But in a certain way, she kind of never had to grow old. She got sick really suddenly and she did her job in a certain way. She saw through what we were out there to do. And she then, I guess, passed me off into the next chapter of my life.
Yeah. What ultimately was it that killed her? What was she sick with?
It was kidney failure, but probably they don't know, but probably like Lyme nephritis. We were just bitten. Both of us were bitten by probably 10,000 ticks on the road. There's most nights I'd wake up with a tick on me or something and pull it off. And even on the medication, tick prevention, she got sick down in Chile with, I can't remember what it's called, but she got really sick with that. And then she probably picked up Lyme somewhere along the way, and then she is predisposed to Lyme nephritis, and then she's kidney failure ultimately.
Got it. All right. Well, let's start at the beginning, because I think a lot of people are fascinated with why you did this, how you did this. So let's start at the beginning. And I know Savannah was not part of the plan when you first started. So my first question is, what made you decide you wanted to walk around the world? And was that what you set out to do? Or did you just say, let me go hike for a little bit?
Yeah, it started off with a friend of mine, a close friend of mine, dying when I was 17. Mm-hmm. And it was just very formative for me. I'd never been close to someone who passed away before. And also the thing about my friend's death, Anne Marie, was that I had known my whole life that she was way kinder than I was, way more intelligent than I was, way more driven than I was, way more thoughtful than I was. And so when she died, it really hit me in the core that, it doesn't matter who you are or what you do, you can go at any moment and it can happen at any time. And of course, you know that intellectually growing up, but it wasn't until she passed that I really felt it and understood it. Mm. And so then it forced me to integrate the idea that you can go at any time into how do I live? And so I reflected for months on what do I want out of life? What are the primary things, if I only get one shot of this, what are the primary things I want to get out of life? And ultimately came to the answer, wanted to travel, wanted to be forced into adventure, and wanted to understand the world. And so then I just really started looking for different ways to travel to satisfy that. Initially, it was backpacking Europe with my cousin, and that kind of fell through. But then while I was down these rabbit holes of internet travel, I discovered these two guys who had walked around the world. And then that was like, as soon as I saw that, it was the light bulb went off. It's like, oh, this fulfills everything that I want. It would be the slow form of travel. if I was afraid of a town that was up ahead or people warned me about a town that was up ahead, I had to pass through it anyway. You know, it wasn't like I was on a bike or in a car. I could just blow by it. And I wanted that. I wanted that difficulty to force myself into growth. And also, I didn't have any money. And so that was an easy way to travel with no money. And so it was when I began, it was 8 years after I first had the dream of walking around the world. I went to school, saved, lived at home, paid off loans, all that. But the intention was always to walk around the world. It wasn't just a hike. And part of that was because I wanted the big adventure. I wanted my life to be changed by this adventure. I didn't want it to be a one-off. You know, even a walk across America felt like it was too small for me because it wouldn't structurally change my life. It'd be a great adventure, but I wanted this to be, you know, something enormous.
Right. So how do you plan for something like that? You said you didn't have a lot of money at the time. So how did you even start with that? And how much do you have to go on something like that?
You don't need much. I think when I was intending to leave, this was when I was 25, I had, I think, just like $25,000 saved. And I figured I could bleed that out for 2 years and hopefully get a sponsor. And I still had student loans to pay off at that point. But the planning, really, there's not too much you can do. I mean, especially then, I think there's more world walkers now. There's more people, not that there's a ton of them, but there's a few more doing it now than when I began. And so it's not like you can like look up and like, how do you walk around the world? You just kind of look up, okay, how do you cross borders? What visas do you need? What's the climate like? And then the rest of it is kind of, you just got to go and like screw up a million times. And that first month of walking, I didn't know what roads to walk. I was walking these roads that were too small and sinuous and cars were almost hitting me. And then I'm walking these massive roads where it's so stressful and loud. And so even something as simple as that was something I needed to figure out. And then how do you find a place to sleep each night? You know, there's times where I slept basically out in the open because I couldn't find somewhere and I have all these mosquitoes biting me through the night, or I sleep next to this like air conditioner next to a church and it wakes me up constantly and I sleep terribly, or I sleep next to train tracks and the same thing happens. So all these little things that I really think there's no other way but to just go through it and figure out how to do it.
Right. Okay. So it's not like you planned on a map, like, okay, I'm going to go here and I'm going to stay here tonight. And you just go through, you just kind of do it day by day.
Yeah. On the larger scale, I knew my route. I planned the route basically by merging the two guys that I had seen had walked around the world. I merged those routes. I wanted to hit every continent. So that was this merging that I did. And then I gave it a rough, like, literally just Google Maps, like if I drove from here to here, like what's the general mileage, and then added some because I figured, okay, it'll take this. And I figured I would average like 14 miles a day with rest days. And that was total shot in the dark. I had no idea like what it would actually be, but I figured, okay, that's probably realistic. And so, and then also the route, primary thing to consider was, how do I do this with as little visa trouble as possible? I didn't want to be waiting around at borders and just dealing with the headache of trying to negotiate a visa or running out of visa time when I'm in a country. So those were like the larger things that I could somewhat plan or just at least give myself an idea of. And then the day-to-day, in the beginning, it was kind of total darkness where I'm just like, all right, I think I'm going in this direction. And I had these bike maps that I was following. I ended up throwing them out. They weren't worth anything. And so it's kind of like bludgeoning my way forward. But as it went on, I would basically in the morning be able to look up on Google Satellite and say, okay, this is 24 miles, 27 miles, 20 miles away. Here looks like some promising places to camp, and then kind of structure my day in that way. And say, okay, let's try and get here. And ideally when I was firing on all cylinders, I would time it out where I was about 3 miles in the morning. At night, I would sleep like 3 miles from ideally like a restaurant or a cafe. And so then I would walk an hour, wake up, get a breakfast, power up, keep going. And then also I would have to, if there's a city up ahead, sleep right outside the city. So then I could walk through the city throughout the day and then be back in the countryside at the end of the day. So there became things to really figure out as it went on. And I got better at figuring out just by looking at Google Earth, Google Satellite. But yeah, in the beginning, it's just like, yeah, I don't know what I'm doing.
So I think it's interesting because if people are listening and they're like, oh, I want to do something like this, but like, how do you even start? I mean, did you have to say, all right, I need to have this much amount of money because there is overhead. I'm assuming you're going through lots of pairs of sneakers. You have to eat, you have to fly. I mean, you can't, or take a boat, you know, you can't just go from one continent to the other. So where do you plan, or how much do you plan? Where do you plan on getting money? Is there a sponsor option? Like, how does that work?
Yeah. So I had saved, like I said, I think I had, it's about $24,000, $25,000, something like that when I was 25. And I knew it wasn't enough. And I wanted to earn more money, but my parents were losing their house. And also I was 25 and I was like, I need my life to break one way or the other. I had more money saved. I had been giving it to my parents to try and help them keep the house. So that kind of slowed me down. I would have left probably a little earlier otherwise. But I figured, look, I have to begin. You know, if I wait any longer, I'm going to get an apartment and you get a girlfriend and you're getting furniture and all these responsibilities slowly end up owning you and keeping you in place. And, you know, the whole idea of living at home was just to give myself a shot at doing this. So I thought, all right, I don't have enough money, but I'm going to try and bleed this out for 2 years, get a sponsor. Luckily, before I began, there was a few articles written on me, Philadelphia Inquirer and jpenn.com. And the owner of this local sign company who knew my friend Anne-Marie happened to be opening up an international branch around that time. And they were looking for something to sponsor and for something to donate to. And so they reached out to me the day after this article was written. And he's like, hey, I want to pay for your whole walk, basically. And it was incredibly fortunate. And you know, it's not like he paid me, I wasn't like making money. He was paying me less than minimum wage, but it was enough to like sustain this. And so the first 2 years, like monetarily, it was, and I took all the money I had saved and just threw it at my student loans, paid them off. But the first 2 years, I lived off of $14,000 a year. And it was honestly, it felt fine, especially in Central South America. It's like I rarely got hotels. And I'm just paying for food, the occasional hotel, one flight across the Darien Gap into South America, another one back from Uruguay. But otherwise, you know, I'm living very cheaply and things are affordable. When I got to Europe, I started a Patreon just because it was more expensive and I knew I wouldn't be able to get by on $14,000 a year. And so that supplemented it. And then, you know, it was, you know, again, I was never in this like to make money. If I had enough money to do it, that was more than enough. And so that's what ended up happening.
Right. I love that. Okay. So smart. So tell us how Savannah came into your life.
Savannah came into my life 4 months into the walk after too many nights of not being able to sleep and thinking someone was coming to murder me or, you know, rob me or whatever. And, you know, totally unfounded, but you're just camping on your own in strange places. And
did that ever happen on your trip?
No, it didn't actually. No. Wow. I was never interrupted by anyone with bad intent in the night. I mean, and I slept outside a lot. And I had, you know, encounters and I'd meet shepherds or, you know, kids who were out and like, they were like mountain or like dirt biking out in the dunes in Peru. I remember that scared me when they came. I was in the middle of nowhere and these guys come over the hill. I'm like, what is happening?
Mad Max going.
Yeah, on. Mad Max. Exactly. Yeah. But no, actually, I never had any actual like malicious encounters in the night. But there's just this part of your brain that is really difficult to turn off. I could do it now because I've just camped out so much and I know probably nothing's going to happen. But in the beginning, it's really difficult to turn off. And so you just wake up 4 or 5 times a night when you're kind of in a lighter sleep and, you know, you hear a twig crack or the branches creak, whatever it is. And so it was through those nights and then this strange encounter with a guy in Georgia where it really put the thought in my head, man, it'd be nice to have a dog that would help me sleep, basically, that could listen because I know it would hear whatever was coming before I did and it would wake me up. So I got to Austin, Texas. Actually got to Houston. I have a cousin in Austin and they picked me up and I was thinking, all right, I'm going to spend a week there and then they'll drop me back where I left off and, you know, continue on. And the first day I was in Austin, I said, I'm going to go check out this adoption center. So I walked over there just thinking, you know, I'm just going to check it out. Spent like 2 hours, 3 hours walking around, you know, meeting these dogs. None of them are really connecting. And right as I'm about to leave, they bring in these two puppies that they found on the side of the highway. And they were really mangy and beat up, scared little puppies huddled together in the corner. And I held Savannah. Her name was Lulu at the time. And I held Savannah. I was like, oh, man, she's so cute. And, you know, she leaned her head on my shoulder. And, you know, I had like a little bit of a connection with her. But I'm also thinking, getting a puppy when I barely know how to like survive on my own is insane. And I'm going to be entering Mexico and Guatemala. And that is its own challenge just to navigate. And now I'm going to introduce a puppy into this. I can't do this. So I'm about to leave. And this other woman who was there looking at these puppies, and I think she just went there every day just to look at the dogs. This is like, that was her thing to do. Yeah. She says, you know, if you leave, the puppies are going to be gone. They won't be here tomorrow. And so she gave me the, you know, that great piece of information, kind of forced my hand. And so I said, all right, like, let's do it. You know, I feel good about this dog. And so as I was adopting Savannah, her sister was being adopted. So they were there for like 15 minutes total time before both the puppies were adopted. And so very fortunate. And then we spent another 2 weeks getting her spaying and vaccinations in Austin. And when we started walking together, you know, she was still just a puppy. So she sat in the back basket of this cart that I pushed, and she was terrified of cars. She hated the leash. She did not care about food at all. So she was so difficult to train. But gradually, little by little, she kind of adjusted. And by the time we reached Mexico, she didn't want to be in the cart, and she was walking the full 24 miles a day, you know, no matter what.
Wow. And did she ever get tired in all the times you were trekking?
Never. No, she was a absolute beast. I mean, like, we would do these 30 mile days in the desert pretty frequently. And I would sit down on the tarp at the end of the night, just unbelievably sore and exhausted, like, you know, seeing stars in my eyes. And she'd be running circles around, or like bring up like a bottle cap or a twig or something for me to play with. When she was like at her peak, and her hair was short, and I had it shaved, especially in the desert or when it's hotter, she was just ripped. I mean, even like by her paws, like her forearms, by the paws, you could just see this muscle. Wow. You know, and as she grew up, that's all she ever did was just walk 24 miles a day.
She loved it. So she absolutely. Yeah.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
I loved it. And how did you deal with like the terrain of, like you said, you were in the desert and all these really hot places? She was fine on her paws. Like, were there times you had to put her in the cart because it was just too hot for her?
Actually, the paws were fine. It was more just the general like heat and humidity. I mean, she has a thick coat. She has a little bit of, she's like 25% chow. And so she has a pretty thick, probably, I guess, double coat. And in, say, like Costa Rica was the worst for the heat. I mean, it was 100 degrees every day, 100% humidity, no wind. And I would just be sweating all night, sweating all morning. So we were waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning, stopping at 10. And so having Savannah, I think otherwise I would have probably just barreled through the heat, but having Savannah made me more attuned to it and said, all right, we actually like need to manage this. But her paws weirdly never had a problem. I think it was just because she grew up doing it and they were like stones. I mean, they got harder and harder as they went. And I tried putting booties on her multiple times and she hated them. She would fling them off and like she was not walking with those things on. So she was the paws, strangely, yeah, never a problem.
Wow. Okay. So explain to people so they can picture this. You did not travel with a pack, right?
Correct.
Explain what you traveled with.
I traveled with a very fancy, you know, New York mom baby stroller, jogging stroller, basically a Thule. And so it had three wheels. And I had seen these photos of the other people who had world walked. And I think only one of them did it with a backpack. Everyone else did it with a cart. And it's just really like, if you're going to do it for 7 years or 5 years is what I thought the walk was going to be. You like having a backpack on your back for 5 years, it would destroy you. Your back would be wrecked and you just can't carry enough either with a backpack when you're, you know, in Wyoming or in, you know, the deserts of South America. Mm-hmm. And it's really not comfortable to like live this uber. You're already living a very minimalistic lifestyle, but to live so minimalistically just out of a backpack would be very difficult for 5 years. So yeah, I carried a backpack with me, but it just had some basic stuff in it. And the rest of myself was in this baby carriage that I pushed. So I'm passing through all these new places and I'm a gangly, tall, white boy with a dog and a baby carriage just standing out.
Oh my God, like a sore thumb. Oh my gosh. And did Savannah go with you on a leash some of the time, or she was always free roaming?
In the beginning, I mean, for years, it was always on leash. I mean, especially in Central and South America, where especially in Central America, it was just more densely populated and the cities are busier in kind of a way that I didn't really understand. And, you know, I was still training her. And so for a long time, she was on the leash. But by the end, I mean, like when we walked across America in the end, I almost never had her on the leash. We could walk 8 hours a day and she would just have her ear brushing my calf all day. You know, she was... When we were working, she was working. She knew exactly what to do. And we were so synced up. We spent so much time together that she knew when it was a road that, you know, she needed to be right with me, like right beside me. And then I would just give her a nod or I'd say, go ahead. And she knew, okay, now I can bounce around and go scent to scent kind of thing. So we were just incredibly synced up.
So I know you've been to so many places where people don't love animals as much as we do, per se. Was there any times that you were nervous about her getting hurt or in trouble?
I would say North Africa maybe was a more challenging one. Central and South America, just because there's more strays. And the strays are, you know, they're just a little more beat up and they're not treated with love, really. So then they become territorial and a little aggressive. So the first 2 years, Savannah and me definitely kind of were living on edge a lot of the time, where, you know, this dog would come out barking and we kind of had to learn to defend ourselves against these other dogs. And I never really like feared for Savannah, you know, dying from that, but she wasn't like a big fan of dogs after the first 2 years. And it took us being home for a while and going to the dog park while her paperwork for Europe was waiting for her to like, oh, like not all dogs are just out to like get me and relax a little bit. But North Africa was a little more challenging because they're just not dog people. It's not a dog culture. There's a lot of cats, but so there's no strays out on the street. But I think I found through Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, I think it was only in Algiers, in the capital of Algeria, where I was actually able to find dog food. And so the rest of the time, I was just buying Savannah like sausages and like beef pate, which she preferred, I'm sure. But obviously, it made it a little like more stressful for me. I was like, all right, I got to find something for her to eat. And then Turkey was a challenging country to walk through with Sav, not because they aren't friendly to dogs. They're like incredibly friendly to dogs, but they just have such a different relationship where the dogs don't come inside and they're just treated outside. And there's a lot of neighborhood dogs and they're spayed or neutered and vaccinated and people treat them really well. And they're like the best looking strays, not even strays really. They're just like town dogs and they're so friendly and there's so many different breeds. But what was difficult was that we'd get to these hotels and be like, it would just be like unthinkable that a dog would come inside. They're like, oh no, like your dog's very nice, but no. Like, it, no, it's
so
not.
What did you do?
There's times we had to just keep walking through the night, you know, into the evening a little bit. But most of the time I could convince them and be like, look, if something happens, you know, I'll pay double or whatever it is. She's not going to do anything. And eventually I could usually break them down and get us in.
Right. Okay. So can you go through the different places over the years where you went? You said you started in America. What was the path and then how you got into Mexico? You said was the second place.
Sure. Yeah. So the first year was New Jersey down to Panama City. So the US, Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Nicaragua. Just do that. Yeah. Guatemala, Nicaragua. And then second year was Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and then a boat down to Antarctica briefly and plant my feet on it. And then it was back to the US to get Savannah's paperwork. While that was being processed, I walked a good amount of Iceland. And then got Savannah, and then we did Ireland, Scotland. I fell very sick from a bacteria infection from South America. It was kind of the slow going thing. So I was actually forced to stop for some months there, lost 45 pounds.
Oh my God.
Very dire, but ended up, you know, figuring it out.
Did you stay while you were sick?
So initially I spent a month, I had a cousin in London. And so I spent a month there. It's kind of in and out of the Royal London Hospital in infectious disease. And they couldn't figure out what was wrong. After a month, I was just getting worse. And then I flew home and I was home again for just like 5 months and until an antibiotic started to work and I was putting weight back on. Wow. And then from there, once I was back to decent physical health, it was Denmark, Germany, France, Spain, or Germany, Belgium, France, Spain, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, and that's like ferrying from Europe and then to Africa and then back, then up Italy, along the Mediterranean, through Turkey, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan. And initially the plan was to walk all the way up to Mongolia through Kazakhstan and Mongolia to Ulaanbaatar and then Australia and then back across the US. But this is COVID. Kazakhstan, Mongolia, Australia were closed. Mm. I gave it like a year waiting for them to open and it was clear they weren't going to open. So I said, all right, like I've been out here for 6.5 years. I'm going to fly home and then walk across the US. So then it was walking from Seattle back to New Jersey.
Okay. So you ended up not doing Australia?
Yeah, no. And yeah, I mean, I would have been waiting, I guess, whatever, 2-3 years before I could have gotten there. Yeah.
Right. I'm curious, when you were sick, what did you do with Savannah? Was she with you? Did she fly back home with you?
Yeah, she flew back home with me and lived a great life. My dad, you know, spoils her. She was in paradise. And she learned to cuddle there. You know, the first 2 years, we were on the job, on the clock, and she did not like cuddling. I remember, like, there's times when I was kind of, you know, like, oh man, I need something to lean on. And I'll like pull her over and put my head against her. And she's like, get off me, dude. Like, I'm going over here to go sit over here. She's like a very independent woman. But then when we actually stopped and we're living kind of this life of comfort, and I just kept grabbing her to pick her up and, like, you know, hold her in my arms kind of thing. And then she's like, oh, this isn't so bad. And so that's when she learned to cuddle.
So, but how did she go from like living outdoors and being outdoors and traveling all day to like being in someone's home while you were recuperating? I mean, did she feel like she needed to get more exercise? Did she understand what relaxing on the couch was?
It took her a while, definitely. Luckily, my dad every morning walks like an hour and a half around this river. So she was getting that every morning. And then he would just take her everywhere and spoil her. So she did all right with that. I think it was actually after the walk was maybe a little more difficult, and maybe just for me, but you know, we had just been walking for so long and that was just what we did. And for a while she would just sit by the door and be like, when are you going out?
Yeah.
It took some months. It took probably 6 months where she was like, okay, I'll just like hang out on the sofa. And then if we're outside, it's too hot. She's like, let's go back in the AC.
Yeah. I'm curious about if you ever got lonely.
Not really. It's sort of this thing. I would say the only times I would get lonely was when I had to wait in a city and you don't know anyone and you're inside and there's just not as much to fill your day. But when I was out walking, it would never get lonely because right. your days are just so packed with newness and experiences. It was only really when I would stop somewhere. And then it felt like the days really sort of expanded in this empty sort of way. And I would wish, man, it'd be, you know, nice and like go get a drink with someone or nice to just like meet someone at a coffee shop and talk a little bit. That's when it was more difficult.
Right. Were you in like, were you connecting with anyone while you were walking? Were you talking to like, I think you said when you first started, you had a girlfriend, right?
Yeah.
How did that work out? I mean, obviously you're not with her anymore, but I mean, how did you keep that or try to date while you were walking?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't really. I mean, so with my girlfriend before I left, we actually like, it was known that we dated the year before and like the first date, I was like, hey, I'm leaving in a year. Like we can keep hanging out if you want, but I'm leaving in a year kind of thing. And so she knew. And so we weren't actually like dating when I left, I guess, per se, you know, but it was still close and, you know, spoke a lot. When I was in college and a little out of college, I had this long-term relationship and I ended that for the World Walk. And so that sort of, maybe I wouldn't say like calloused me, but it taught me that it's like you can't get close to anyone right now while you're doing this walk because it just demands too much. And, you know,
it could be distracting. It could take you away from what your original goal was. I know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so for a long time, I just never really allowed myself to get close to anyone romantically. As the years went on, I got like more and more exhausted in a certain way of always having that guard up. And so I let it down as the years went on a little bit, and it would cause, you know, maybe a little bit more difficulty, but that was kind of, I'd just been out for a long time. It just became, it was taxing emotionally. But yeah, I mean, as I was going, I would meet people all the time. You know, I'd have people invite me in, or if I was in a city for a little bit longer, you know, it's hard to make deep connections. I'd make a lot of surface level connections for a night or two kind of thing of locals who were really kind. And if I stopped in a place, say for a month or for a couple of weeks, then I could meet people and hang out with them and build deeper relationships. So there's, you know, met a lot of great people, had a lot of great people help me. But the deeper relationships were definitely one of the things that I was missing and longed for during those years. But that was kind of, you know, like anything, any big commitment, there's going to be some sacrifices. And that was one of them.
Sure. Do you have any regrets? Do you like, what was your big takeaway from doing this?
Yeah, no, I don't have any regrets. No, it's fantastic. I would say my only regret is like, I should have just kept like, I should have just always had Brevecto on me or something. I should have had like name brand tick stuff sent out instead of using off brand stuff in some of these countries. But no, I mean, otherwise, like in a large scale, no regrets. I would say the big takeaway really is, and something that it just took me a long time to fully understand is just people are really small, you know, and in the sense of, well, like personally, you think, you know, motivation and willpower is enough to direct your life perfectly. And like you can nudge your life this way or that, but really, you know, you're decided by your geography and the economy you're born into and your family, how they messed you up or how they didn't mess you up. And, you know, I would just meet people everywhere who were smarter than I was, kinder than I was, more driven than I was, definitely more generous. I remember like, I'd meet all these people where like, I'd be found on their land or like, you know, I'd just be passing through and they were so warm and welcoming. I'd be like, I wouldn't be the same. I would have been so suspicious of this creepy guy sleeping on like the edge of my field. But I was the one walking through their country because I had an American passport and I had like the American currency behind me. And these guys were, you know, it's like a cattle rancher because his dad was a cattle rancher, or, you know, he's selling motor oil to passing trucks because that's what's available in the desert, or, you know, he's a shepherd in Turkey because that's where he was born. That's what he's been doing. Mm-hmm. And so in a certain way, this idea that people are small and that we're small is like very liberating because you're able to sort of relieve yourself from the pressures of becoming something. And if things don't work out, you can go, you know, that's how it is, and be more accepting of your own flaws even. And then in the other way, it's really frustrating because it what it tells you is that like good systems really matter, you know, yeah. like good economic policy, good governance, like transparent governance, like really matters. And otherwise you're just messing up. You're putting down like millions, billions of people's lives and that are just trying to make some money and hang out with their family. So yeah, that people are small is definitely was like the most transformative, I would say, lesson that was really driven home to me.
I'm curious how you found people to be in terms of different countries as well. I mean, like we see all this strife and turmoil that's happening now, you know, in a number of different places. And, you know, we're told, especially in America with the media, we're told how these people are, how they think of us. What was your experience with other people in other cultures within each other and then experiencing you as an American?
Yeah, well, this is exactly like people are small and people are the same everywhere. It's you. I would have in the first 2 years in particular, every country like, oh my God, this is going to be crazy. I'm entering El Salvador. I'm entering Peru. I can't imagine what it's going to be like there. And then you get there and it's like, oh no, it's just like people hanging out just like everywhere else. Right. And they're eating different food and their clothes change and the landscape changes, but it's just people like making money, hanging out with their family everywhere. And you know,
essentially we're all the same.
100%. Absolutely. Like no doubt about it. People are pretty nice everywhere. They're doing their best everywhere. Right. And, you know, the structural things change, you know, where, you know, countries get caught in a resource trap or, you know, they get, you know, they have a dictator and, you know, they tank, you know, whatever the economy or their, whatever it is. But the people on the ground, the average person is the same everywhere. They're pretty kind. They're well-intentioned. And, you know, this is just by virtue of producing any sort of content, you like want to talk about interesting things. Like that's just the virtue of it. And I think it's important to understand for, you know, the layman, for the average person that, you know, a podcast, an article, like they're there to be interesting, mm-hmm. but there's not a story to be written about another 10,000 people lived in peace in this town. And that's like the majority of the world. It's just people hanging out and, you know, that's it.
Right. Can you name some of your favorite places that you went to that you would even consider living in?
Definitely Turkey. I love Turkey. Just such kind, warm people.
I love Turkey.
Did you? Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of Backroads?
No. Uh-uh.
It's a biking company. Oh, so cool. I went on a 14-day bike through Turkey. I guess it was through Bodrum down to, and I'm going to pronounce it wrong, Ankara.
Yeah, Ankara. Yeah.
Yeah, Ankara. Okay. And then kind of around and back. But, you know, I also did it through Morocco and I've done it by myself each time, but I mean, with a group of 15 people. But I always found it interesting that, like, because you stay in 5-star hotels at night, okay, but you have a bike and you have a path and you kind of go at your own pace and there is a car that follows you. Turkey to me was so beautiful. And we would stop for lunch and meet these women who are making the Turkish, you know, the rugs and have the apple tea and all that. And it was gorgeous. And then in Morocco, I found that fascinating because you go through these switches. And I remember being completely alone on a path and seeing, I don't know the official name, a shepherd, like you were talking about with these goats. And I would pull over on the side. And people would say, oh, as a woman or, you know, a young girl too, be very careful. You shouldn't be doing this. But I found it fascinating. And I remember sitting there thinking like, what the hell does this guy think about all day? Like he has the goats and he has the sun and there's no newspapers. There's no podcast that he's listening to. Like I didn't get it. So I just would sit there. And I also found it fascinating that he knows every movement of every goat and knows them intimately, but eventually they have to be killed for food. Right. So I couldn't understand it, but I found it so amazing to sit there and just see how other people live and how different it is and beautiful. And, you know, there's all parts of it that, you know, you take a little from each place and you're just like, oh, I love that. I love this. You know what I mean? Okay. Sorry.
Definitely. So no, that's great.
But Turkey was amazing.
Yeah, I totally agree. As you saw, I'm sure it's like European enough feeling that you feel like you're at home in a certain way, but then it's has the Asian and African influence on top of it. So the architecture is different, the food's a little different.
Yeah.
So yeah, Turkey is definitely up there. And it's also very easy to stay in Turkey. Like you could like logistically do it. I'll say, and then right up to the east, I would say Georgia is another country. That was probably my favorite. And a lot of that is because they don't have any resources. This is ex-USSR country, but they don't have any natural resources like Azerbaijan next door. And it's a young democracy. And you can just tell like everyone cares and everyone's hustling. And so you get amazing restaurants, you get amazing music, you get amazing artwork because everyone is just trying to make their lives a little better, you know, and rather than it being this, you know, country dominated by oil wealth or, you know, some mineral wealth, whatever it is, it's just one man on the ground at a time trying to do their best. And you really feel like this vibrant energy throughout Tbilisi, the capital in particular.
Yeah.
So those two are fantastic. I would love to move to Denmark just so I could ride my bike everywhere every day. That was really nice.
Yeah.
And
sure. I've never
and
been
like
there.
The Colombian cities are fantastic as well. Very lively, very passionate and great food.
I forget. Did you say that you've walked through areas like Vietnam and over there?
I didn't because of the visa stuff. So that's why initially going up to like Mongolia was the easier way with the visas. It would have been, I don't even know. I mean, I guess I could have done it, but it's like Iran. You can't, as an American, you wouldn't be able to walk or you can't even get an entry into without like it being a tour. Afghanistan, probably the same. So I don't even know. I mean, I guess there would be some way, but yeah, it's hard to get over that world, over to that section of the world walking.
Yeah, right. Was there any time that you wanted to give up?
Yeah, definitely. There was.
And were your parents, by the way, like, when are you coming home?
No, my dad was like, go stay out there longer. My mom wanted me home for sure. Yeah. Yeah. But once after the first year, I think then she was like, okay, he knows what he's doing. He made it. He'll do fine. Yeah. After I got sick with that bacterial infection, I had just been in pain for so long. Like I said, I lost 45 pounds. I was vomiting. I was having these stomach spasms and it was just like nightmarish for a few months at least. And then when I picked up walking, you know, my body gradually came back, but my mind was just scarred from all that pain. And so normally I'm a very optimistic person. And instead, all my optimism was sort of turned to pessimism. And when you're out walking all the time, you know, it's wonderful because it's just you and you. And you get a really clear shot of all your thoughts and all your emotions. And it's clarifying and it's insightful and it's really therapeutic. But if you're in a bad state, it's difficult because you are not good company to yourself. And when it was raining, I would just be infuriated. I can't believe it's raining. This is, oh my God. And then I would camp and I'd go in and I'd be like sore. And then I'd just be pissed off that I'm sore after another day walking. And I would wake up and I go, oh my God, I can't believe I have to, I would walk another 24 miles to nowhere. I get to a cafe and it was closed and I would like scream at the sky. And it was just, I was just not good company to myself at all. And so, yeah, there was points where I was thinking, man, I would love to be back home with my friends. And I remember talking to my best buddy, Fitz, and he was in New York and, you know, he's doing his thing. He's hustling. And he was like, dude, you don't want to be back here. Like I work all the time. Your other friends work all the time. This is something you dreamt about for years. Like, what are you going to do if you come back here? You're just going to work some job that you don't like and that, you know, you left to do this. And, you know, that conversation helped. And I knew that. And I think what helped get me through ultimately was that, you know, the World War was this thing that I had found through my values. You know, it wasn't something I did lightly. And I don't think you could do it lightly, but you know, at 17, when I thought about what do I want out of life? And that's what I came up with. And so I think I fell back on that because when I really played it out in my head, what would it be like if I gave up and if I moved back home? It's like, I don't want that. I'm living a great life out here. It sucks right now, but this is fulfilling everything that I wanted. And eventually I was able to kind of get out of that darkness when I got onto the Camino de Santiago in Spain. And that was the first time I had like a community of people walking in the same direction I was. And it was just helped me get out of my head a little bit, you know,
right.
get to.
Did you do that whole walk or did you do just parts of it?
I did a lot of it. I did it until the point, basically from the Pyrenees all the way down to Via de la Plata. And then I walked Via de la Plata, which is another Camino. So I walked more, I would say I walked more Caminos than the average person does, just if they did the Camino de Santiago. So I probably walked like 80% of the Camino de Santiago.
This is so random. My mother, who is 78, for the last couple summers, she'll go with like four or five friends and they do a portion of it.
Yes.
And they like got a tattoo on their foot and they stay in like, I don't know, youth hostels or something. One time she got bed bugs. I mean, this is like an old woman doing this, but she figured that this was, you know, like a very cool thing to do every summer with a group of women or whatever. And it was like life changing and very fun for them.
That's like my dream. You see people on the Camino, it's very made for that because towns every like 5 miles and you can get people to just take your bags and send it up to the next hotel. And you could do it at 70, clearly. I mean, she's doing it. But I would recommend it to anyone for sure.
Yeah. Do you have, I know you have a million memories that are amazing to you, but do you have one that you could share with us that for people thinking of, you know, if this would be something they want to do, like just share a memory of like something that really stood out that made the trip for you?
Sure. I'd say like the height of the trip, I would say, was when I was actually even physically at the highest point or pretty close to the highest point that I've ever been. And so this was after a little over a year and a half, almost 2 years of walking. I was crossing the Andes from Chile into Peru, and I left this little oasis town. And that's at 6,000 feet. And then the first day, this is a crossing. It's a 5-day crossing to get up to this little border town up in the Andes to Argentina. And there's nothing up there. You're just in altiplano. But that first day, my cart was weighed down with as much water as it had ever been, probably weighed like 110, 120 pounds. And I had to push it up 9,000 feet in elevation to get to this plateau. And so that first day, I'm just like, I camp up there. And then also you're at altitude, so your body's not really healing as well as it does normally. So I'm in the best shape of my life, absolute physical max, but I am exhausted and my body's not recovering and it's cold. And at night the tent frosts and I had to bring Savannah into sleeping bag. I wear all my clothes. So I'm not sleeping great. And after 3 nights of this or 4 nights, I camp in like the middle of nowhere, basically, where the wind is probably going 50 miles an hour. I find this little chain link fence that's around some pipeline, probably like a gas pipeline, you know, thing that's just in the middle of nowhere. And I tie my tent up to that and I sleep maybe 2 hours. You know, I have so much sand on my tent that it's basically a little coffin slapping against my face. Savannah slept outside. It was too loud. She's like, I'm not sleeping in there. She dug a hole and slept outside. And in the morning I get outside and I'm so tired. I just throw everything in my cart. Usually I pack it nice and neat. And then I began pushing the cart through the sand and the sand, you know, it's tough to push through. It's tiring and you're slipping and your feet are slipping, the tire's slipping. And the cart slips a little bit to the right. And I'm basically leaned forward already just to edge this thing forward. And I fall face first into the sand out of exhaustion. Like my legs were just like had nothing left in them. And so I just laid there for who knows how long, just like face in the sand, totally exhausted. And thankfully at this point, it was a perfect morning, you know, like the sun's out, there's no wind. And eventually I turn over, just like face the sun. I'm like, all right, like you gotta like gather your strength here. And Savannah comes and sits beside me and I'm laying there. And it was just like the height of everything in the sense of I push my body to the point of collapse. Like how many people do that where you actually collapse from exhaustion? And then I'm at 15,000 feet in the altiplano, over 8,000 miles of walking from home with a dog, with my best friend that I never imagined I'd have. It was like, I could see us and you have the children's book. So there's a moment in the children's book, which is, that's the real moment. And it was just like everything that I had hoped to get out of the walk was held in that little moment. And it was beautiful.
Wow. I love that story. What did you listen to all day?
I listen to music, I listen to podcasts, listen to audiobooks, all sorts of stuff. I was constantly listening to stuff. A lot of Eagles podcasts for entertainment when it was the Eagles season, but all sorts. I was like so deep in the podcast world that was the primary entertainment.
Got it. So you didn't just listen to the elements, you had something going on to help you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, and if it was like, if I was on a busier road, I would put on like Tiesto's Club Life, like electronic music or something to like drown it out. And be like, all right, you're just going to focus for the next 2 hours and just like get through this. And then when it was quieter or I was relaxed a little bit, then I'd put on a podcast or an audio book or something. But yeah, I listen to stuff all the time. And, you know, when you're doing it for, when you're walking 8 hours a day or 10 hours a day, you know, it's not like you're paying attention to all of it 10 hours a day. You kind of go in and out. A lot of it was just like, that's nice to have like a voice in the background while I'm out here.
So at what point do you realize you're done? I mean, you moved back to the United States. You came back home. Are you done? Will you do more walking eventually?
I might do more walking, but I'm not walking around the world again. That is no way. By the time the walk was over, you know, I pushing that baby carriage when I was thinking, man, I'm going to throw this thing off the Ben Franklin Bridge. I can't wait to get rid of this thing. I was so over it by the end. You know, it's a beautiful life. It is. I say the 7 years felt like 20, like every day so packed with experience. I grew so much, but it's difficult. You know, you're out there on your own. You're in the elements every day. You're tired every day. You're always slightly on your heels because you don't want to offend anyone. You want to like be respectful of people, especially when you're abroad. So you're always a little bit on your heels. And even coming to the US, it was nice to be able to relax in a little way where it's like, all right, this is my country. You know, I can be how I want to be in this country in a certain way. Probably, you know, I'm already thinking about, man, I would love to do, you know, the AT or the PCT or something like that. And who knows, maybe it'll get there. But as far as walking around the world with a baby carriage, that's one and done.
It's over. The next time you have a baby carriage in front of you, maybe it'll be your own child.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So you have now become a public speaker, correct?
Yes.
And you have a book coming out in October called The World Walk. Can you just tell people a little bit about what to expect with that?
Yeah, The World Walk is just a great adventure story. I put 2 years of writing. I've been writing since I got out of college. I really enjoy it. I wrote all along the walk. I kept detailed journals and then obviously photos and videos. So this was, you know, this book is the culmination of my growth, basically. That's the story it's telling, is me going from this naive suburbanite who has no idea what the world is, how to defend himself against the world, into someone who has a greater understanding and who knows how to, you know, survive anywhere, basically. So ultimately, it's just a great adventure story. And it's kind of a love story. You know, me and Bonnie, my girlfriend, also Savannah, who's like the Sam Gamgee of the story, who's there through everything, getting me through everything. So it's a lot of different elements. You learn a lot about the world. It was a joy to write. And my editor was fantastic. It was, I think it's a really fantastic book. So that's The World Walk, coming out October 8th. Mm-hmm. Get it anywhere. And then, yeah, the public speaking is something that just kind of came naturally after the walk finished. I got invited to speak at Pinterest and then a photography shop. And I realized, oh, like, I actually have something to say. When I think if I did it years before, I would have felt like a total fraud. It's like, who are you to get up there? But I have things that help people get through daily life, help them navigate life, help them set a course and then follow through on that course, and things I believe in. And so it kind of came naturally, and I've been speaking, you know, all over the place, and booking.com and Handshake and you know, schools, all sorts of stuff. And, you know, sharing this message of resilience that I believe in and I believe helps people. So it's been a nice balance.
Well, I think it's so interesting because when you were talking, it made me think about when you were talking about, you know, if you had given up and come home and then work some 9-to-5 job, there are so many people just stuck in their life and they don't know what's missing. They don't know how to change. They don't know how to get out of it. And so they do take vacations or they change a little bit. But I think the ultimate underlying current there is that no matter where you go, there you are. And you better like who you are and figure out who you are and your purpose, because you could be in a 9-to-5 job and be really happy. Or you could be out trekking the whole world and have to go find yourself and realize you've been with yourself the whole time. So I think it's an amazing story. I think it's amazing you had these opportunities. and to go around and do all these things that you will probably never get to do once you do get married and have children and you can experience things here and there. But what an amazing journey that you've had so far, and you're still so young. So what is next for you? By the way, do you and your girlfriend have a new dog?
We don't yet. It's a rough summer. We are looking. I think I'm getting to the point now where I can like consider it a little bit, maybe in a few months or something. We're definitely dog people, so it'll come eventually.
It'll come.
As far as what's next, I'm not sure. I'm going to keep writing and really enjoying the public speaking, the motivational speaking. I think it's fantastic. But as far as, you know, the next adventure, we'll have to wait and see. I'm not sure.
Right. We will have to wait and see. Well, I wish you the best of luck. I think you're fascinating. I cannot wait to see what the future holds. Will you still be updating people on your Instagram so they can go on your next journey with you?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Instagram, where it's all at, the World Walk, it's all on there. I'll continue updating. I'm reading excerpts of the book right now. That's what's happening on Instagram.
Let people know what your Instagram is if they're listening so they can find you.
Yeah. So it's The World Walk. That's how you can find the book, the Instagram, all of that. And if you want to relive the adventure, you can go way back into the Instagram and just go photo by photo and see the development for yourself day by day. I mean, I post it almost every day. And so that's a fun way to go live vicariously through me and Savannah.
Amazing. I love that. It comes out October 8th. Everybody should get it. And also, you have an amazing children's book out, and you said you have another one that will be coming, correct?
Yep.
I got it for my daughter, and I wanted to interview you first. We're planning on sitting down later with the dogs to read it. So I'll have to send you a picture and let you know how that goes. Anyways, I wish you the best. I think you're amazing. You're so inspirational, and you really deserve the best. And you do have a message. You have a story to tell people, and I think it's very helpful. So thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. You're a great interviewer. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.